This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are speaking with Philip Zelikow, professor of history at the University of Virginia. He has served at all levels of American government with expertise in American defense and security, war and terrorism, and the presidency. And that's just the short list. Reading his brief biography actually could be an entire radio show in and of itself. So here's just a brief taste of that. Zelikow directed the 2001 Commission on National Election Reform, chaired by Presidents Carter and Ford. He was executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He's been on presidential intelligence advisory boards, the National Security Council staff, and the Defense Policy Board, and served as a very close advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice under George Bush. He's authored several books on topics from the reunification of Germany to Cuban Missile Crisis. Zelikow was consulted recently for Slate's article, Is There a Way to Prevent the Next Charlottesville? He is on a task force, Rework America, which we'll also discuss. And we are also looking very forward to talking with David Von Strawn, Solidarity Seville member and community organizer right here in Seville. If you have questions for a guest during the show, message us on Facebook at 947WPVC and text me if you know me, and we'll take your questions. You can check out all our podcasts on the station website, 947WPVC.org. But first, Nancy, are you there?
I am here, Ellen, and I have to say, after listening to this amazing intro that you did, if we were in high school right now, we would totally, this is like the ultimate extra credit assignment we are undergoing today with these two guests. I mean, you can't really do much better than this, and I kind of wish that we could turn in some pop points.
Exactly. In high school, Nancy and I used to get extra credit points, pop points. What even that stood for, I have no idea. But it gave us incentive. But you're right, this is an amazing show, and we've outdone ourselves.
So good day to you, and we'll just let the two people next to you just talk, and we'll, you know, sign off at the end, play the music.
Right. So, our guest, did I mention? Yes, he has expertise in voter fraud or voter election stuff, too. And that's something I wanted to focus on a little bit today with the upcoming general election here in Virginia. The Voter Election Commission, Trump's, is based on lies about voter fraud that basically just, I think they just lay the groundwork for a massive voter suppression campaign. And I'm really just I need to vent about that a little bit, I think.
Well, that is totally a concern because we don't know what they're doing with this data, you know. And once upon a time, I do remember that the secretaries of state were saying, no, we're not sending you this data, but somehow I feel like they got something because I keep hearing about Chris Kobach and what he's doing with Pence about the voting rules, and I am totally paranoid about this. I mean, I was able to vote on Tuesday. My name was on the list, but, you know, it's just that whole feeling that they are looking for blue people and people of color and anyone that's not going to vote Republican, and it's very unsettling, so I get your outrage.
Yeah, I mean, the whole commission, which is, as you mentioned, led by Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, is just filled with people who've made a career of voter suppression, and it's just based on lies. There are seven lawsuits against it now, and they're using personal email servers.
Yeah.
calling for background checks, and it's being normalized, and that's the scary thing. It has no legitimacy whatsoever.
Right, and he's actually using some of his microphone, soapbox, whatever, to rail on DACA as well, lying about why, you know, how they are here taking jobs from Americans and they're criminals when they're not, and, you know, as similarly with this, the voting fraud notion, just spreading lies and feeding into the narrative that Trump's base just apparently thrives on. And apparently, unless the media is, of course, focusing the way they can on things that are not necessarily epidemic, it seems like this may be the thing that Trump can't shoot in the middle of Fifth Avenue. He seemed, but I don't know. You know, I don't know if the media is making more of Trump's seemingly wiggle back to the DACA people can stay, or if it's true that his base is really that enraged by his decision to sit down with Chuck and Nancy.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, one thing I was thinking about this week was how many times since November have you heard the expression from politicians, including Republicans, seasoned news people like Dan Rather, that they've said, I've never seen anything like this before. So,
oh,
you know, these times, it's a real test of our democracy, don't you think?
Yeah, in fact, sometimes I just feel like every news show should just start with, sit down, everyone. You know, today you're not going to believe this one, or you know, give you a moment to inhale and exhale, and maybe bring you the top news today.
Totally. Well, let's get right to some events, and some relate to what we've been talking about. Again, I wanted to mention the upcoming general election on November 7th, and the deadline to register to vote or update an existing registration is October 16th. And here we're voting for governor and lieutenant governor, many positions. It's the biggest election since Trump took office. And there's things you can do with Indivisible launching a 9-week Tonsler Park door knocking canvassing drive. Today is also Seaville Pride. Happy Pride, everybody, from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Pavilion, downtown Charlottesville. Lots of events there, including Butterfly Vendetta, a band that we are close to here in the studio. And then today there's Sabroso, Latin music and culture festival at the Ix building, hosted by Sin Barreras, from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. And let's get right to the show.
Yeah.
We have a fantastic show today. Our first guest is David Von Strawn, Solidarity Seaville member and community organizer here in Charlottesville. Welcome, David.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you. Well, I'm saying welcome. This is my show. My show's tomorrow.
Yes.
Tune in to Homegrown at 10 o'clock. But no, thank you for having me, Ellen.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
It's really great to meet you. I know you rearranged your schedule to be here, and we really appreciate that.
No worries. I wanted to be here.
Good.
I believe him.
That was genuine. You should.
So much has happened. It's been a month now. I know you're doing a lot of work here. What do you think, what do you want people to know right now? What have you been working on? Where's a good place to start for you? What would you like to talk about?
Well, first of all, I want to say that, A, thank you for having me on the show. B, I'm not the only one that's doing the work that is being done in Charlottesville. There's a lot of wonderful organizers and activists, predominantly black and brown women and queer femmes, that are doing the work that is necessary to bring to light all of the injustices that are going on in Charlottesville. I think the Black Student Alliance of UVA is doing great. The UVA Students Union had a wonderful demonstration at the Rotunda, which showed solidarity with the work that Solidarity Seaville has been doing. And I just want to commend those students for coming out and speaking their piece and letting their voices be heard in the name of everything that's been going on. So I don't want to take credit and be like I'm the one that's, you know, doing all of this work and other people are following. I'm kind of following all of the other people that have been doing all of this work from the very beginning for years, even since Occupy Charlottesville. So shout out to them and inspiring me and amazing, you know, work that they're doing and very commendable from start to finish, and they lose sleep, they lose time with their family, they give up on social activity, you know, they don't give up on, but they, you know, they
prioritize.
They prioritize their time in lieu of social activities and, you know, peace of mind, quite frankly. They do the work that other people sit and criticize and don't do. So I just want to give my ultimate thanks and gratitude to those people those women, those femmes, most of which I am in organizations with, Solidarity Seville, Surge Seville, Congregate Seville, as well as Black Lives Matter Charlottesville, which I am a member of, which is an unofficial chapter, but we're working on that, and we're working on getting national recognition. So just want to say thank you to all of those people, first and foremost.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday at 10 a.m. We're talking with David von Strawn.
Hey, David, I've read a few of the things you've written, and one of the things that I definitely want to ask you about is this notion that white residents, we feel we are progressive, especially, you know, in particular in your city, which is, I know, what only you can really speak about, but this idea, well, we're progressive, so what's, you know, I'm not part of this problem, right? And how would you like us to rephrase that question? What, I know there's something wrong with that because there's, we are responsible too. So what is, in your view, what is a white person's responsibility to this mess of racism?
Well, I would just say, you know, plugging yourself into the system. I think that apathy is the primary problem of a lack of resistance. Evil prevails when good people do nothing. You guys were just talking about the election as I was walking in. 20% of the entire population of the United States voted for Trump, and he won. So if people, for lack of better words and pardon the language, got off of their ass and plugged themselves into the system, got out, organized, became active, voted, and used their God-given abilities to make a place or in America, or just a place in general to, you know, because, you know, screw colonization, to make this a better place for the people that are most marginalized and the people that you supposedly represent and the people that you supposedly care about. I think what's going on is there is a latent and passive racism that I don't even think progressives realize. And I heard a lot of progressives, you know, before the events of August 12th and July 8th, saying, well, this is, you know, if you go and, you know, counter-react to this rally or these rallies, then you're giving them fodder to be angry about. And you just have to ignore it, David. You can't go there and give people something to scream at. This is the right way to do it. And I despise that notion that the right way to do something is to believe that it's not happening. And a lot of progressives will just sit in their homes and, you know, sit with their friends and drink coffee and talk about how messed up the world is and how messed up Trump is, but they don't get up and do anything about it. They don't plug themselves in. They don't support the organizers and activists that are doing anything. They sit there and they criticize and they cajole and they talk about, well, you know, this angry behavior. Well, people have a right to be angry. People have a right to be outraged. This is this is the most apropos time to be angry and outraged and to do something about that and to show your anger and outrage. And I don't subscribe to the belief that love should be gentle and love should be kind. There is tough love. There is aggressive love. There is firm love. Antifa is a perfect example of that. They come out and they defend their communities through in a rage, and that rage comes out of deep abiding love for the most marginalized people in our country and the most marginalized people in our communities. These black and brown people that are disproportionately affected by stop and frisk procedures, these black and brown people that are affected by affordable living wages, and you know, predominantly in Charlottesville, where the wage disparity is astonishing, and we just see more and more buildings getting put up for rich white college kids and their parents. And you know, how does that How is that progressive? You know, how does that make a place better and equal for everybody in the community? You're just making it better for rich white people like yourself, and you call yourself progressive, but there's no progress. It's still the rich white people getting everything that they've always gotten in the country, and still the poor, the downtrodden, predominantly black and brown people being marginalized and being forgotten. So, I mean, you can talk about how progressive you are and how much you care about black and brown people till the cows come home, but until you actually plug yourself into the system and put yourself in the place of these individuals, then you haven't really done anything.
You know, as for the media covering what you're describing, especially since August 12th, not that it hasn't been going on, obviously, for 100 years, but since then, do you feel they're addressing the picture any better? Do you feel like the notion that white supremacists are terrorists is getting out there? What's your view?
Well, I honestly don't think that's happening personally from my perspective, because I'm not hearing that enough. And I think what white people need to realize is that white supremacy is a white people problem. It's not just a problem for minorities and people of color and people of different lifestyles and alternate and people of different genders and things of that nature. It's a white person problem. When a white person is walking down the street and they can't tell the difference between a white supremacist and just a basic hipster with a clean cut haircut and a non-shaven beard, then there's a problem, because you've created a universe where you can't tell the difference, and now you're in a place of paranoia. Now you're in a place of trauma. You see these people come in, and that's what I heard, like, right after August 12th. It's like, I heard from white people, it's like, I don't know who these people are, and I don't know how to distinguish these people from, quote-unquote, normal, average people. It's like, so who's this person in my restaurant? Who's this person in my bar? Who's this person in the supermarket? Who's this person talking to my children? You know? So I think in order to really address the problem is to really realize that it's everybody's problem, predominantly white people. We didn't create racism. We didn't create white supremacy. We didn't create a system that is imbalanced and unequal to a lot of people in this country. White people did. So it shouldn't be upon the shoulders of Black Lives Matter, per se, and Solidarity and Antifa to solve this. They're coming out to defend this behavior that people just kind of let go by the wayside. And it's like, oh, well, they just have a bad view of things. And, oh, well, you know, they might have, you know, certain views and perspectives, but this person's my cousin. No, really, he's a good person. Well, then talk to them and let them know that, you know, you love and care about these black and brown people and people of color and people of alternate lifestyles, because the conversation is the only way we're going to get through this hard conversation.
That's David Von Strawn. We're speaking with him. He's a member of Solidarity Seville and a community organizer here in Charlottesville. We're going to be talking with Philip Zellico after a little while. He's a professor of history at the University of Virginia. We're going to go to break right now, and after that, we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with David Von Strawn, Solidarity Seville member. In about 5 minutes or so, we're going to talk with Philip Zellico, professor of history at UVA. He served at all levels of American government with expertise in American defense and security, war and terrorism, and the presidency. Right now, we're talking with David. David, I had a question. I know you're working on an article. You're interviewing local organizers here and activists. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I already have, actually. So I was lucky enough to sit with about four local activists within the regional communities of Virginia and so on and so forth. Actually, you know, they're outside of Virginia, but I just want to make everything as loose as possible for security purposes, I said everything would be confidential.
Sure.
You know, because of the heavy doxing that 4chan and 8chan of the I refuse to use the term alt-right because it sanitizes the nature of white supremacy and Nazism that these people represent. So I know that white supremacists are doing a lot of doxing, a lot of investigation on who these activists actually are so they can torment and intimidate and even harm these individuals. So I try to keep everything confidential. Anyway, I had lovely conversations with all of them. People who are ingrained in their communities, not only with organization and activism, but also do some do artwork, some write comics, some do blogs. One woman was getting married. She was planning her wedding at the same time as starting her work in activism. One person has children. So I just got a chance to talk with all of these people and see how they balance their lives of organizing and activism along with, you know, the daily social, in the daily work grind that we all have to do. I mean, we all have jobs. Some have 9-to-5s. Some like the doctor over here can, you know, choose and do whatever he wants to do. But, we all have lives to lead and we all got bills to pay while we, you know, work through while we do this work as activists, and it can be emotionally draining, it can be physically grueling, but these people are resilient and these people are strong and these people are willing to sacrifice every spare moment of their lives in the fight against white supremacy. And I find that to be quite revealing and inspiring in my work as well, because, you know, we, you know, a lot of people talk about how they're tired after work and they sit and they just watch Netflix and they go to bed and then they get up and go to work again. But these people, they never stop. They get they lose hours of sleep. Like I said, you know, some people don't eat enough. Some people don't get to do, you know, they don't get to go to movies and they don't get to like hang out with their friends. Some people don't have friends anymore because they've chosen the path of activism.
Do you think that what people are doing now is what they were doing in the civil rights movement? You know, you've heard that, I'm sure, before. Like, what you're doing right now is what you would have been doing in the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that history always repeats itself in some way, shape, or form. And it's funny because somebody shared a picture with me about how the Nazis were storming into a town in Germany. I forget the name of it. But you could see the Nazis were moving in, and the German police were standing alongside, not doing anything. And it was kind of familiar and parallel to how the police in Charlottesville kind of stood and did nothing while Nazis wreaked havoc in our town on that day. And It just goes to show how history just keeps repeating itself, and we keep still committing the same mistakes that we have in the past. The civil rights movement was in fact a movement, just as, you know, the feminist movement came in three waves. I believe there was the first wave, you know, with Elizabeth Cody Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and then there was a second wave of the women of the 60s. Actually, I believe it began with Sojourners in Truth, the first wave, and then the second wave was Cody Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and then there was a third wave, which kind of trickled into the civil rights movement as well. Movements come in waves, and the civil rights movement was by far not the end of, you know, gaining justice for people of color and people of different lifestyles. I think that there has to be a refreshment of what is important and what we're losing and what we haven't gained as people and as a society, which is equality and equity and fairness for everybody underneath the sun. And we have moments where we just kind of wake up and realize that, okay, it's getting crazy out here. We need to do something about it. And I think the murder of Trayvon Martin kind of sparked things for me personally, where I kind of, quote-unquote, woke up to the fact that we as black folks just aren't safe in this country anymore. Even when we do nothing, even when we just walk through a community with, you know, an iced tea and some Skittles, we're being seen as criminals, we're being seen as violent, we're being seen as savages, we're being seen as a threat to America. And even while being as young and as, you know, gentle-faced and as baby-faced as Trayvon was, we're never seen as the same. We see the disparity in prison sentencing. White people who do the exact same crime as black people get far less time in jail and, you know, probation and less bail or even, you know, out on probation or whatever, and black people get remanded to bail. They get stuck in prison cells. Sandra Bland is a perfect example of that. And some are never seen or heard from again.
This is 94.7 WPVC. You're listening to Apropos of Something.
You know, David, you have actually been quite generous in your even understanding how a white supremacist formulates his or her logic, their hatred. And yet, you are very adamant about, which I totally understand, about wishing we would see them as labeling them more like ex-cons, like it's a label of a, you know, that point of view is more, should be taken as seriously or as significantly as like a criminal record. And I was wondering if you could, I hadn't read anything like that, if you could explain more how you arrived at that determination for them.
Well, I would even go as far to say that they're terrorists. I would say that they are domestic American terrorists committing terrorism upon people of color in this community. And until we actually put that label on them and everybody agrees to label these people as terrorists, then I don't think that their decision making will be swayed. And I just want to make something perfectly clear. I don't hate the person, and I hate the philosophy. You know, I understand that that racism is targeted by people who are disenfranchised, by people who are poor, just like people of color, people that are forgotten about their country, just like people of color. And they say, these people target them, and they say, well, you know, the reason that you're in this situation is because of the blacks or because of the Mexicans or because of this or because of that or because of identity politics, and they're taking over your country or whatever. And these are people that, you know, haven't created, a mind, or I don't want to say a mind, but like, a self-confidence within themselves and an ability to guide themselves through the world as confident individuals. And what racism and what terrorism does is it preys on the weak-minded, and it turns people into excuses, and it turns people into and it blames individuals for faults that we have and mistakes that we make on our own. So, you know, I hope that these people can come to terms with what they're doing is, what you're doing is committing terrorism upon the people in your country. What you're doing is just straight up hate. And if you're fine with that, then that's another conversation, and that's another action. But if you aren't, then a conversation needs to be had, and you have to do some serious thinking. But until we, you know, view these people as not as, oh, well, they're just, you know, they just, you know, have a certain point of view or whatever, until we actually like hardline these people as committing terrorism upon this so-called, you know, this country that they supposedly love and that they're supposedly fighting for, then we're not going to get anywhere. And that's up to white people, that's up to black people, it's up to everybody.
Thank you so much for being here. I know
you
have a schedule to keep today.
Yeah, I wish I could be here longer. But
you'll come back.
Yes, yes. Okay. Hopefully you'll have me.
Thank you so much. I'm going to say this on the air, Nancy. Can I just take your picture? People love to see the faces with the...
The mustache is for Jitney, by the way. Go get your tickets to Jitney.
Are you in that?
Yep. Oh, yep, we just had opening night last night.
Little plug.
So, yep.
Great. African-American Jefferson
School African-American Heritage Center.
That's it.
It's going on tonight, tomorrow at 2. Next weekend, same times, 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock on Friday and Saturday, and 2 o'clock on Sunday. Ellen, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure to meet you.
All right. Back at you.
Okay.
Thank you both so very much.
Yep.
Have a good day.
All right, you too.
Hey, Nance.
Hey. I got some news of note. I'm moving the show forward as time is making me do that.
Okay. Do it.
Okay. You had mentioned this at the top of the show, and I am circling back about Virginia and voting, that Virginia is being, you may know this, is being referred to as the first flippable state, that all 100 seats in the House are up for election this November. And I raise that, of course, because we're mostly in Virginia, but all the states are interconnected, and Virginia's semi-automatic weapons laws and the pollutants laws and lack thereof, they don't respect state lines. So I call attention to that for everyone, that policies cross state lines, and to pay attention to what's going on in Virginia. And because, of course, you're a classic example of a state that usually votes blue, but yet 66% of your House is Republican because of gerrymandering and voter suppression and voting laws that they make. So go to, just Google Virginia flippable. There are other states that are like this, but you are apparently the one with all 100 seats, and a lot of eyes are on you in November. So just Google Virginia flippable, because the website is just too complicated to announce.
Well, thank you, New York City. I really appreciate that. And let's not turn us into Kansas, which they require proof of citizenship to register to vote, and that means you have to show your passport, your birth certificate, or naturalization papers, which many people don't have. And that's Chris Kobach's state, the guy on the Voter Suppression Commission. And so that has blocked 1 in 7 Kansans from being able to register to vote. So that's 30,000 people. So this is one of the, I think, and that's why we talk about it so much, a very key issue.
Yeah, no, that is a good point, and he is once again coming, a word on a name on our minds today, apparently. Anyway,
yes. Please. So, with no further ado, I wanted to introduce again Philip Zelikow, the White Burkett Miller Professor of History in the Corcoran Department of History at the University of Virginia. He has served at all levels of American government with expertise in American defense and security, war and terrorism, the presidency, and much more. Zelikow started as a trial and appellate lawyer in Texas. He joined the Foreign Service, starting an illustrious career advising presidents on foreign policy and national security. He directed the 2001 Commission on National Election Reform, chaired by Presidents Carter and Ford. This work led directly to congressional passage of the bipartisan Help America Vote Act of 2002. He's been a member of both G.W. Bush and Obama's President's Intelligence Advisory Boards and on the National Security Council staff for President George H.W. Bush. He was executive director of the 9/11 Commission, which I really, really want to talk about with you, which produced 585 pages, a complete account of the circumstances surrounding the 9/11 terrorist attacks, including recommendations designed to guard against future attacks. He's authored several books on topics from the reunification of Germany with Condoleezza Rice to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Welcome, Philip Zelikow.
Glad to be here.
And how many business cards does it take to put all that on there? Go ahead, Ellen, please. I don't want to waste your time.
I know.
Please, Ellen.
Well, let's talk about Charlottesville, because this time's going to fly by. We had armed paramilitary groups here dressed in full militia wear, others with shields, helmets, all that kind of stuff. So which amendment wins, in your opinion, the free speech or right to bear arms? And I know you've argued a case like this in Texas when you were there. Tell us about this and your views about the law here.
Yeah, it's a great topic, because I think a lot of Americans are now a little bewildered at the way the First Amendment and the Second Amendment are coming together. They see that all these people are parading, carrying assault weapons, and claiming that this is just a right of free expression combined with their right to bear arms. This is actually not quite right. There is actually a solution to this problem, and I think that if the Charlottesville protests had occurred and all those people with assault weapons had not been carrying arms, I think that it's a very different kind of occasion. and much more manageable by law enforcement and much less dangerous. Take the weapons out of political confrontations. So it turns out that when I was a lawyer in Texas in the early 1980s, I was the co-counsel in a suit that went after private military organizations in Texas. Back then, more than 30 years ago, the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan had a private military organization that they called the Texas Emergency Reserve, and they were using this to harass Vietnamese American shrimpers on the Texas Gulf Coast. My colleagues and I brought a lawsuit that said that under Texas law, it was illegal to have these private military organizations, and that these illegal organizations were being used to intimidate people. The courts agreed with us. The Texas Attorney General joined our lawsuit, and the court shut down the private military organizations. Shut them down, and it worked. The harassment stopped. People were able to go about their business. It set a powerful legal precedent that actually has was followed only a few years later, again in North Carolina, similar situation, and again using the state laws that ban private military organizations, the threat of using armed men in political confrontations was taken out of the picture. But time has passed and people have forgotten those precedents, and here we're seeing the private militias come back again, taking part in a political confrontation. And the point that I was making in a couple of pieces was simply that, folks, it's time to remember these precedents that we set, again, using state laws. And by the way, Virginia has just such a law, too. And actually, the Virginia Constitution is pretty clear on this point.
So this is fascinating. Unfortunately, we have a hard break. We're going to come right back and continue talking with Philip Zelikow about the First and Second Amendments. We'll be right back. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are honored to have with us Philip Zelikow, the White Burkett Miller Professor of History at University of Virginia. He is an expert on many, many things, including the First Amendment, Second Amendment, Constitution, etc., war and terrorism, the presidency. So we interrupted you for a heartbreak. If you could continue just talking, we're talking about Charlottesville and what happened here with the paramilitary.
Yeah, my only point is that we have a country where people are going to have political demonstrations, they're going to have protests. What made the Charlottesville event so dangerous was that into a political confrontation, you injected private military groups of people organized to come to a political confrontation with assault weapons. This was an incredibly dangerous situation. Especially, by the way, for the law enforcement people there, who then had to change the way they might have approached the situation because they were conscious that at any moment firing could break out and a lot of people could be killed very quickly. So I'm pointing out that actually there are precedents, which my colleagues and I helped establish actually back in Texas in the 1980s, and then have been followed again in other places, using state laws that ban private military groups. So no, the Second Amendment does not give you the constitutional right to form a private military group that brings organized groups of armed men to political confrontations. That is not a constitutional right, and it's actually prohibited by state law in most states in America, including Virginia.
Do you happen to know what's being done about that? I know I heard talk of Tim Heafey coming in to investigate.
I think Tim Heafey is now taken on the responsibility of doing an inquiry that's going to look at the whole way law enforcement responded in the Charlottesville episode and make recommendations for how to proceed in the future. There are some teams of attorneys who are actually looking at possible litigation that will use Virginia state law in order to try to take the private military groups out of political protests.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so frustrating that you're telling me that Virginia actually has law. It's not even the case you argued, which seems, you know, like someone should have thought about that. But there's actually case law if I heard you right, there's case law in Virginia that could have.
No, it's in the Virginia Constitution and statutes no one has actually applied the Constitution and statutes on this point in Virginia in a long time. And so people, I think, actually have just, when we confronted white supremacists in an earlier era in the 1980s, these laws were invoked and effectively used. And my point was, since I was a veteran of all of that, is just to remind folks that those precedents were there, because I actually think that people had forgotten about them.
Is there any wiggle room with these armed militias where they can tell whomever that they're not militias, that there's some other group that you know, is a loophole in this fight against keeping them at these kind of protests?
Well, you can have a good legal argument about how to define a private military organization or a private militia, and we've had those arguments. But it's interesting to point out that these groups actually proudly call themselves private militias. They actually have given themselves names. You notice, by the way, at the protests that they wear standardized outfits, have some standardized equipment, that there is a command arrangement among them in which people are responding as an organization. These are all the classic criteria for a private military group, which is prohibited in Virginia and in most states.
Well, that is true, and I'm just worrying now that they'll get smart about it and start, you know, dressing differently and whatever. But you are correct. Obviously, I've seen those pictures, and they were very proud about it. So.
No, and at the point where you have to break up your organization or to conceal your identity, I mean, if you're organized and your people are all arriving at the same place at the same time, then you've just hidden the organization. You haven't gotten rid of it. But if you get rid of the organization, the private military organization, and you're not showing up in an organized way, armed for confrontation, then you've already made your political process a lot safer.
And so you feel towns have, any town, because I know they're planning this in, I think there's one going on in Richmond today, if I'm not mistaken, I'm not sure, but do you feel any every town has a right to prevent these kind of rallies from organizing?
Yes, in conjunction with the state. In Virginia, for example, state authorities, I think, have these laws actually go back to very disturbed periods earlier in our history. And therefore, a lot of people have simply forgotten that we have these laws on the books. But they're there because there were times in American history where people were very worried about dangers like these. And sadly, it's time to brush the dust off and use the laws we already have on the books.
And actually, Ellen, I just want to sneak in one more First Amendment question before you go to the 9/11 stuff. Completely different use of the First Amendment, Philip. What is your view of what Sarah Sanders has been doing at the White House podium in terms of, well, I'm just going to use her words, insisting that ESPN fire Jemele Hill for calling Trump a white supremacist?
Well, that's just a political argument in the culture wars. There's no legal issue there one way or the other.
It's not a First Amendment thing.
I don't think there's really a First Amendment issue on either side. The White House is not using legal power to force ESPN to do anything. They're making an argument to try to inflame a culture war narrative that they think helps them politically.
So, thanks for the introduction to the next topic, Nancy. Right on point. I really wanted to talk about, you were the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, which its full name is the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States. It was an independent bipartisan commission created by Congress, or legislation, and signed by George Bush. And it asked you and your team to prepare a full and complete account of the circumstances surrounding 9/11. And including preparedness for immediate response to the attacks, and it mandated you to provide recommendations designed to guard against future attacks. And I was reading it, and it's just chilling. I mean, if it wasn't real, and if I were removed from it would be a great, you know, novel to read. But it is so detailed, and because I was very close to the scene, I haven't delved into details like this, and maybe now I'm first. Beginning, I think I could. I obviously did it last night. It's an amazing document, and you reviewed 2.5 million pages of documents for this report.
I and 85
other people.
Staff who,
yes.
Right.
You, by you, I mean your commission.
Yes.
And you interviewed 1,200 individuals in 10 countries. You held 19 days of hearings, heard testimony from 160 witnesses. So my question is, did we take the measures that you recommended? You know, did we do anything since then?
Well, I actually, frankly, because of the reaction of millions of people just like you, who read the report and put it number one on the bestseller list, Congress cut short its summer recess in 2004 to come back and pass legislation to adopt most of our recommendations, the recommendations that could be adopted with legislation. So they reorganized the intelligence community. They did a variety of constructive things. The administration created an entity, and Congress created an entity called the National Counterterrorism Center that actually doesn't get much attention but has been a highly useful entity to pool information about possible threats and in ways that were not possible before 9/11. So I actually think that they have helped make the country safer in a lot of ways since 9/11, and I think that's evident in the fact that the United States has no longer become a staging area in which international terrorist groups can send their people here to prepare and train to launch catastrophic attacks. It doesn't mean that we're safe or that any advanced country can ever be truly safe in an era like this. Our job is to try to make us more resilient. I think most people are adult enough to realize that we live in a world that can never be perfectly safe.
Mm-hmm.
What they understandably want is that people are trying hard to learn from what happens and do the best they can in a reasonable way to try to keep us safe.
Do you think our military is 21st century thinking enough to address counterterrorism since your commission?
I think in some ways, yes. That is, there are some things that we're doing overseas that are very advanced, and there are even some things that I think some people may find troubling that we're doing overseas. But it's the military has learned a lot of military lessons about how to counter terrorist groups. I mean, we're in the midst right now of completing the destruction of the Islamic State and its home bases in eastern Syria, in Raqqa. A campaign that actually has been relatively successful. My critique actually is that in some ways the military side of this is so much in the foreground that we neglect enough attention to the political aspects of the strategy, because what you're really about is a huge crisis in the Muslim world. That's what's producing all of this. And ultimately that's going to be solved with a political strategy that changes the Muslim world and that produces over time healthier societies in the Muslim world that don't nurture this incredibly violent generational struggle inside the Muslim world that is spilling over into Europe and elsewhere.
So I wanted to tell Nancy something. The station just let me know that we're going to run a little bit over because we want to talk to Philip a little bit more, and I couldn't agree more. So we have a little more time, Nance.
Okay.
If you can stay, can you stay? We did not even ask. We didn't even ask you. Okay,
that's true.
I kind of assumed that Jeff talked to him actually, but because he was out there on a break. But if you can, just for five minutes over,
sure, of course,
five more minutes of your time. Okay. So I wanted to ask you just recently. I think it was just end of this last week. A pair of senators, bipartisan senators, is moving to create, and they called it a 9/11-style commission to examine the cyber attacks that took place during the recent presidential election. I don't know if you knew about that, but Kristen Gillibrand and Lindsey Graham got together. Do you think that there's a chance of this happening, and do you think that given the political climate right now, there's less, you know, do you think that there's any chance in heck of it happening?
Yeah, actually a couple of people in Congress have been talking to me about this idea. There are two aspects of this. First is we have to look backwards, and the second is to look forwards. So the look backwards part, we have to really understand what happened in 2016. So we've got two big efforts underway to understand what happened in the past. There's Special Counsel Mueller's investigation that's underway, and then there's also the work that's being done by the Congressional Intelligence Committees, both Senate and House. And the Senate investigation is a little more advanced under the direction of the Chairman Richard Burr and Ranking Member Virginia Senator Mark Warner. Then there's a question, though, of once you've understood the past, how do we prepare for the future? How do we make recommendations as to how we can make our election process safer and protect its integrity? And then deal with these cyber threats. I actually think there is space for a significant bipartisan effort of some kind that tries to tackle the future piece. I think it's hard to... I wouldn't advise necessarily a commission to try to add yet one more investigation into 2016 on top of what Mueller and the Senate Intelligence Committee are already in the midst of doing right now. I'm not sure that that makes those investigations run any better.
And I know this is different, so I ask, after the 2000 election, you were you directed a bipartisan commission on the federal election reform. Are those measures that you found then, are they still in effect? Are they still in effect? And should there be something like that going on again, another Help America Vote Act that you did in 2002?
Yes, they are still in effect. A Help America Vote Act aid, which in the acronym they use is HAVA, the result of the legislation was to give states billions of dollars to update and improve their election administration systems. That actually worked a lot. You haven't heard much about hanging chads in recent years. You have heard, by the way, of things called like provisional ballots, where there are questions about whether someone is appropriately on the voter rolls. They can go ahead and cast a ballot and check it out later instead of turning them away. Provisional balloting was one of the recommendations from our commission that was enacted into law and has had a big positive effect. So, there is an Election Assistance Commission that exists right now. It's a good commission. It pulls together best practices from states and counties around America and tries to improve the way our elections are run. What's happening, though, is that basically HAVA money is running down. The election systems that were updated in the early 2000s now need basically to be updated further and protected against cyber threats. And the Election Assistance Commission's work on best practices needs, which is good and is doing well, needs a shot in the arm to deal with these new cyber threats and needs to be spotlighted so that communities can learn how to protect their systems against possible cyber attacks in the future. And there's some real scope for work on this that could be very constructive. And the good news is that the foundation, the Election Assistance Commission, the HAVA aid, all that foundational structure is there, and it's pretty good.
We're going to go to a hard break. We're going to be back. We're going to run a little bit over with our guest, Philip Zelica. We'll be right back. We're back. This is Apropos of Something, going a little bit after the hour so that we can talk more to Philip Zelica, the White Burkett Miller Professor of History at UVA, serving all levels of government, expert in American defense and security, war and terrorism, the presidency. He was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. So let's continue our conversation.
So, Philip, you know, it did sound very good, what you were saying about HAVA, Help America Vote Act. I'm just curious, now that I've heard that laws can be forgotten and constitutions don't get reread enough, what you're describing, can you answer this? Are you confident that those things that you just described, protections for voting, et cetera, are still in effect in 2018, for 2018? Does that stuff just happen?
Others are more expert about this now than I am. The good news, or the bad news, elections are mainly run by states and counties. So really, I think people need to just look at the situation in their states. Like take here in Virginia, for example. From what I can tell, I think the Virginia authorities and the state and county authorities here who run our elections feel pretty good about the way they're running their system. And I think we in Virginia feel pretty good about the integrity of our election system. But other people can look at the situation in their states and think about how they feel about it.
So I wanted to, since we only have a couple of minutes, I wanted to get to your recent work, which is with Rework America, and you've written a book for that organization, America's Moment, Creating Opportunity in the Connected Age. Can you tell us about Rework America?
Sure. This is a great organization. The original Rework America Task Force was co-chaired by Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, and Zoe Baird, who is the president of the Markle Foundation. The task force has just been rebooted again under the executive direction of Dennis McDonough, who was President Obama's chief of staff. Here's what Rework America is about. Rework America thinks that we're undergoing one of the great economic revolutions in American history, which is the digital revolution. And that just like the Industrial Revolution transformed everything about the American economy and society, the digital revolution is in the early stages of making that transformation again. Now, the Rework America argument is we need to adapt to this new revolution. And actually, if we're smart about it, we can do really well with this because America is really positioned to be able to succeed and offer a lot of opportunity to people coming out of the digital revolution. You know, one of the stereotypes people have is that it's people versus machines, and the machines are going to take away all our jobs. This actually is not, when you get into the details of this, this is actually not really the way the digital revolution usually works or needs to work. In fact, the digital revolution can actually empower people and make their jobs better. It can allow people to, instead of a more standardized system in which you have to fit the system, increasingly the system is being individualized to fit you. Imagine a medical aide who, armed with a tablet, can extend the whole knowledge of a hospital network to your bedside at your home, and a minimum wage medical assistant becomes a more empowered employee of a whole healthcare system because they're the cutting edge of a network empowered by network technology. And you can have an upside both for the people working in the system and for the consumers. There are a lot of interesting examples of where private firms and state and local governments are taking advantage of the digital revolution in innovative and exciting ways. You know, a lot of the national narrative is about the federal government and what the federal government could or couldn't do. But in fact, a lot of the most exciting things happening in government today are happening at the state and local level. The TomTom Founders Festival here in Charlottesville is a wonderful example that showcases innovation and entrepreneurship right here in our community.
And your role in it, I know you mentioned there are so many people. How do you participate in this organization?
Oh, I was in the first Rework America Task Force. I was sort of a kind of executive director for the task force, which was composed of civic and community leaders from both parties and no party, corporate chieftains, community organizers, and the current task force is similarly a very diverse group because we're actually not caught up in the issues that define national politics today and that people argue about on cable news every night. We're looking past that to think, what are the real ways we need to think about organizing our economy for the digital revolution, and mostly talking about issues that politicians now are not talking about nearly enough. For example, how do we make our welfare systems more portable so that if you keep changing jobs, your welfare packages can follow you wherever you go? How can we make student financial aid less tied to residential colleges and more flexible to be used as people construct all kinds of lifelong learning programs for themselves? And on and on. Now, Mark Warner, the senator from Virginia, is actually one of the best legislators thinking about this. And he sometimes calls this agenda Capitalism 2.0, which is a pretty nice label for it, too.
Yeah, it's like coming up from the gray clouds when you're leaving an airport when it's horrible out, and you just like get above and you see the blue in the sky, and everything you just said makes me feel like, yes, this sounds like people wanting a better life for each other. Go on, please. Continue. I love that this, I didn't even know, it's so typical, I didn't even know this existed, and apparently it's not recent, you know, you said it's already been revised, for crying out loud.
It's pretty recent, we're really talking about the last few years.
Well,
and so if folks are interested, Google Rework America and see what you find.
Yep. Well, thank you so much. Yep. This is a first in the history of our program that we have kept a guest over because of how esteemed you are. So thank you.
It's my pleasure. An excellent group of people to talk to.
Yeah. Well,
thank you so much.
Yeah. Please, please, can we beg you to come back? Thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have time for, not that that wasn't pretty palate cleansing, but I actually have one. Do I have a second? What do you think?
Yeah, do it.
Okay. All right. On this date in 1978, you're going to love this, Ellen. I don't know about you, Philip. I don't know if you're a Monty Python fan, but principal photography began on The Life of Brian today back then, and it was shot in Tunisia, and apparently the last film that had just shot there was a Franco Zeffirelli film, Jesus of Nazareth, so Terry Jones, who was directing, was often told by these local Tunisians after he would shoot something, well, you know, Mr. Zeffirelli wouldn't have done it like that, you know, and he said it was just such an odd thing to be told by elderly Tunisians how to direct his major motion picture. That is my palate cleanser.
Yes. You know, I'm regretful that I didn't get to ask Philip about North Korea because I was just terrified.
Because I sucked up the air with this?
No, okay. But Philip, yeah. Can I email you about that? I need to rest better at night. Thank you again. Nancy.
Yes.
Well, it was a great show, and I will talk to you next week. I wanted to say, remember, that no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Bye, Nance.
Bye-bye, Al.